Do you have an acquaintance who seems to have it all? You know, the job, the marriage, the house, the kids, maybe even a vacation home or two. Don't you sometimes want to hate that person, but you can't because they're actually generous, they're humble, and they're working really hard for their success? Do you know that kind of person I'm talking about, Tom?
Absolutely. They're all over social media, right?
That is what social media is. Yes.
They have their perfect life, their perfect family, their perfect job. Everything's great. But it usually is never really what's going on behind the scenes.
And sometimes I'm almost seeing after doing this podcast, Tom, you know, we've been doing this a year now.
Is it really? Wow.
Yes, we have been doing a year. So happy podcast birthday to Annis.
Woo!
That is almost a sign, is what I'm learning from doing this podcast. It's almost a sign if someone's too flashy with their wealth, that
right.
Something just isn't right. And that's what today's story is all about. This is the kind of man that Alan Fabian portrayed himself to be. In the year 2007, 40-something-year-old Alan Fabian is beloved by many. He lives in Maryland, where he owns multiple businesses. He works in the tech consulting space, and he takes pride in creating jobs for the community. He's also a loving husband. He's a father. He's heavily involved with his kids' education. And he's a volunteer, too. He volunteers as a board member at the kids' school. And when Alan's wife, Jackie, struggles with various medical conditions, he takes on extra childcare duties without complaint. Alan is also a good Christian man. There's the tipping point, Tom.
Of course.
One time, a young man stole a nativity scene from his front yard, but Alan forgave him and told the police he didn't want to press charges.
And Alan's rich. He flies on private jets. He owns 2 beach homes. But he gives back to the community and shares his wealth. He lets his less fortunate neighbors stay at his beach properties for free. And he's even started a nonprofit that provides computers to underprivileged schools. Everyone loves Alan. He's a person you can really rely on. So when in the spring of 2007, a criminal indictment against him is released, it's a shock. It doesn't seem possible that a man who's done so much good for so many people could be a criminal. And yet, he is.
This is episode number 37 of Tax Crime Junkies, and we're calling this one Just When You Think You Know a Person, Alan Fabian's Savvy Scheme. Welcome back, everyone, to Tax Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a certified tax strategist, a CPA. I have an interest in true tax crime, a degree in law, and lead the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners. And with me today is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Hey, Dom. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I've admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court as a non-attorney. I'm a tax instructor, and like you, I have a real interest in true crime. We decided to create a true crime podcast to combine our love of mysteries, whodunits, and tax. We are the Tax Crime Junkies.
This is an interesting one, Tom. We've got a guy who was actually pretty savvy in the way he conducted his fraud. He managed to fool a lot of people for a long time, and he probably could have continued to do so. But, as is the case for a lot of these stories, Alan was blinded by insatiable greed.
That's right. So let's unpack Alan Fabian's years-long criminal scheme. The year is 1986. Young Alan is graduating from college, which a bachelor's degree in accounting and finance and economics from Shippensburg University in Pennsylvania. Then he lands himself a job at Arthur Anderson, which at that time was one of the nation's largest public accounting firms.
So let's see, 1986, was it the Big 12 then?
That's a good question. I know there were a lot more, let's just say it that way, right?
Yes. So side note, and this is kind of intriguing, but we know what happened with Arthur Anderson. They shut down in the early 2000s. as a result of being convicted. They obstructed the government's investigation into the big Enron scandal. And eventually that conviction was overturned. But today, Arthur Andersen is kind of famous for their alleged involvement in that Enron scandal. They're kind of making a comeback a little bit as Andersen Consulting. But now we really have no idea whether or not Alan Fabian might have even learned some of his shady business practices from working at Arthur Andersen. But it is something to wonder about. Anyway, Alan works at Arthur Andersen for a few years, and he does some consulting work and prepares tax returns and does audits as well.
Around 1995, Alan and his wife, Jackie, buy a modest home in Baltimore County, Maryland, where I used to live, fun fact. Alan is listed as a CPA at this time. Then in 1998, Alan and a business partner from a company called Strategic Partners International LLC, or simply SPI LLC for short, note the LLC, that will become important later on.
According to the court documents, SPI LLC specializes in information technology, aka IT, and they also provide activity-based costing and consulting services. So if we translate that into more basic terms, I imagine that SPI is helping companies get a better grasp on their costs, along with providing them with tech solutions to help make those more effective.
And one of the solutions that Alan's company engages in is something called a sale and leaseback transaction. A sale and leaseback transaction works like this. Let's say you're a company that needs to free up some cash. You could do this by selling off some assets, like real estate or equipment. But that's not always ideal. What if the equipment you're thinking of selling is necessary for your everyday operations? Enter the sale and leaseback agreement. This is an agreement that allows a company to sell their equipment and then lease that same equipment back from the company they just sold it to.
Kind of an ideal situation for Alan Fabian, right? Because he specializes in tech. He's also doing cost accounting to help people be more effective in their costs and cash flow. So in this arrangement, let's say you own a business, and in Alan's case, he's got the tech specialty. So let's say the business owns 100 or so computers. The employees are using that stuff every day in the office. But let's say the business is short on cash. They would sell those computers. In exchange, they'd get a lump sum of cash. But instead of the buyer taking possession of the computers, the computers stay in the office. And instead of then owning the computers, the business just leases them back from the party that purchased them. And that's how they now have a new transaction occurring, gives them the money they need. The purchaser makes money on the deal. Make sense?
Yeah, it does. So if I sold 100 computers for $1,000 each, I get $100,000 in exchange. I now have $100,000 to spend on whatever my business needs, and I get to keep using my computers so long as I can continue to make monthly payments to the company who bought them.
Exactly. And to make it even simpler, a sale and leaseback arrangement is like selling your house, but you don't move out because now you just pay the new owner rent. And we actually use this as a tax reduction strategy in the right situation. We do it as a gift leaseback scenario, but you have to be careful with what types of assets you use that for, because there are related party rules.
Mm-hmm.
If the assets have been depreciated in the business, there may be some recapture involved.
Right.
But you get the picture with the sale leaseback and the gift leaseback agreement. The business is using the assets and they're making a payment of lease that becomes a deductible expense on the tax return.
So being on the selling end of a sale and leaseback transaction is something Alan's company does. He works with a leasing broker called Solarcom. Solarcom finds third-party funding for these transactions. Once Solarcom secures the funding, they purchase a specified amount of equipment from Alan, then lease it back to Alan. Alan, under the umbrella of SPI LLC, pays SolarCom for 3 months of the lease, and subsequent lease payments go to the third-party funders. This whole song and dance makes Alan good money. The same year that SPI LLC is formed, he's able to purchase a larger home for his family.
No kidding. Couple years go by, and in July of 2000, a government consulting company called Maximus actually acquires SPI LLC, and they pay $1.8 million for that acquisition. And so now we still have SPI LLC intact, but it becomes a subsidiary of its new parent company. And now Alan is actually a Maximus employee. He gets the title of division vice president. And we're not really sure what Alan's duties are as Maximus division vice president, but it's possible he's still doing those sales and leaseback transactions with SolarCom. But no matter what the job entails, Alan is bringing home the bacon. The same year of the acquisition, he buys a four-bedroom beach house in Holden Beach, North Carolina, and everything in Alan's world is peachy. He's sold off his successful company, and now he's got a high-powered job. He can afford to go on family vacations. He sends his kid to a really good private school. So what exactly is the crime here? Well, things, of course, start to take a turn in 2001. That's when, according to court documents, Maximus merged SPI LLC into itself and out of existence.
According to one of Alan's former colleagues, Alan's division didn't mesh well with Maximus. And in 2002, Alan forms a new company while still working for Maximus. His new company is called SPI, Inc. A little close to SPI LLC, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think for a lot of times, people don't understand the nuance between an Inc. or an LLC.
Right.
So when you get bankers involved or even just the layperson, so let's say Alan is consulting with different companies, they probably wouldn't understand that there's a difference between SPI, Inc. and SPI LLC, or what's now known as Maximus.
And he doesn't tell Maximus about his new company that he's formed, and he doesn't tell SolarCom that SPI LLC doesn't exist anymore. Then using SPI Inc. is intentionally misleading. He wants it to look as though SPI Inc. is a subsidiary of Maximus in the way that SPI LLC was, even though it's not. And when it comes to his dealings with SolarCom, Alan acts like everything is business as usual.
So really what we have here is, because the LLC got absorbed by Maximus, I imagine that Maximus was a much bigger company. They probably had greater cash flow. They probably had greater assets that they own. And so Alan wants to present this image as this brand new corporation, kind of having all of those positives. Otherwise would just look like a brand new company that really doesn't have any history yet. And so between 2001 and 2003, Alan doesn't have all the equipment that he's purporting to sell and lease. When we look at the court documents, he sends fake quotes and invoices to SolarCom that make it look like the equipment he's selling cost more than what he actually bought it for. And in some cases, he tells SolarCom that he purchased equipment he wants to sell, but in reality, he hasn't even purchased that equipment at all. Instead, he fakes it by fabricating records of wire transfers that show SPI Inc. wiring money to various computer manufacturers.
You know, what's really interesting here is that this business was successful. He sold it for good money. He's making good money at this other firm, but it's still not enough.
Right.
So he had to go ahead, and now what was legitimate is now a crime.
Right. And maybe it's the, you know, always needing to one-up yourself,
right?
Because there's only one way down from the top, Tom, and that's you go down,
right?
I've seen this with really talented athletes. I imagine mentally that's really a struggle to be at the top of your game when you're in peak physical condition. And we all get older, our body ages, our body breaks down, and it's got to feel like a plummet
right.
when you're coming down from the top. And so perhaps it's that pursuit of constant outdoing yourself. What's even more ridiculous in this whole story is that Alan allegedly purported to sell and lease back software licenses that were given free to Maximus for use in consulting engagements. And that's just really egregious. So Maximus is getting it for free. Alan then takes that and goes, hey, I bought all this stuff. Here, give me money for it. And he's turning it into cash for himself.
And of course, Maximus is not even related to this company, right? So which is
at all.
Even worse. And if you're wondering just how much Alan making off this scam, let me tell you, between 2001 and 2004, SolarCom paid Alan and his entities close to $32 million.
Wow.
Now, in turn, Alan furnished $16.2 million in lease payments to SolarCom and other funding sources. If you do the math, that's almost $16 million he pocketed.
So that makes sense, right? Because to keep the con going, he's got to make the lease payments. And if he's doing all of this with non-existent assets or free software, where would he get the money for the lease payments if it
right.
doesn't exist and he's not using that stuff to generate profits, right? So he had to have kind of set that aside. And with the fortune that he pocketed, he does everything in his power to raise his social profile. Now he gets a $1.5 million, 7,500 square foot mansion,
big.
Which he renovates to include a pool house with a kitchen. So big. You've got to have that kitchen for the pool house. You
of
can't be
course.
Bothered to walk back into the main it's house.
Plummet, Dominique. Come on.
And the property is even featured in Baltimore Style magazine. Did you ever read that magazine when you
I
lived in
read
Baltimore?
It once or twice, yes.
He gets a Lexus. He gets two Audis. He gets a $100,000 yacht.
Mm.
And the Fabians say goodbye to flying commercial. Now they can afford to take private jets to their summer homes in North Carolina. And I did say homes, plural, because now Alan owns more than just one.
But Alan does more than live a flashy, extravagant lifestyle. He spends a portion of his wealth, albeit ill-gotten, on giving back to the community. In 2003, Alan forms a nonprofit called the Center for Management and Technology, or CMAT for short. The cost to form and operate CMAT was $3.9 million. According to his wife, Jackie, Alan was inspired to start CMAT because he watched too many companies pay for expensive consulting reports, but not have enough money left over to implement the report's recommendations. So the organization's mission is to help other nonprofits improve their technology. It also provided computers to underprivileged schools. Jackie says CMAT was formed out of, quote, need, not greed. Funny. Additionally, in 2003, Alan formed the American Patriot Political Action Committee, which contributed to the campaigns of several Republican candidates.
Wow. It's like the man behind the curtain. Don't look at the crimes that are being committed here. Just look at all these good things I'm doing. And that's because, of course, behind the curtain, he's not as saintly and charitable as he seems. In 2002, 2003, and 2004, he files false tax returns. So this is, of course, outside of the crimes that he's committing,
right.
because we know, we've talked about before, Tom, that you still have to report ill-gotten gains on your tax returns.
Yeah.
So he was already doing that.
Right.
But He also fails to report income received, and he overstates the amounts of income tax that was actually withheld from his wages.
That's an odd choice to do, but okay.
Well, you do have to imagine this is 20 years ago, so the IRS supercomputers may not have been as reliable as they are today about catching those types of cross-checks, right? But that is an interesting scam. But that's, of course, that's what we're finding out from all of the court filings is what that says.
You know, and it's interesting from doing this podcast for so long, Dominique, you know, it's rarely the tax issue that's the lead, right? They're usually committing some other crime that which then leads to a tax crime, you know,
right?
Like this, you know, he's stealing money, right? And then files false tax returns in order to obfuscate what was other crime is going on. But once one is found, the other is always going to also be found.
It's usually easier to prove, too, when you think about our court system and the fact that you have a jury system of your peers. Sometimes these scams can get pretty complicated, and trying to explain that through evidence to a jury can be tough when you're dealing with very complex financial schemes.
Right.
Whereas when you say very simply, look, here's how much money came into the bank during the year, and here's how much this guy reported on his tax returns, it's usually easier to persuade the jury that something's actually happened nefariously. And because of the way that Alan set this up, he eventually runs out of money to keep up with the lease payments to Solarcom and the funding entities. So coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, he leaves his job at Maximus that year. He's been working for them, and all the while he's been pretending that SPI Inc. is a part of Maximus because it's Inc. versus LLC. In any regard, Alan can't keep up with the lease payments because he's been pocketing the millions that he's getting from the equipment sales, and he's not using that money to generate more money. Instead, he's spending it on living large and playing pretend philanthropist.
So eventually, in late spring or early summer, he finally defaults on 11 leases. And because Alan purported to Solarcom that Maximus would guarantee the leases, Solarcom goes after Maximus, demanding payment.
Oh.
Maximus is blindsided. They never signed off on any sale-to-lease-back agreements. They had no idea their former employee, Alan Fabian, was running this racket behind their back. And they are pissed. In turn, Maximus sues Alan Fabian and his companies along with the business partner.
Yikes, that means the jig is up.
Yes.
And not only that, but the lawsuit instigates a criminal investigation led by the Department of Justice. They don't see too keenly on using another company to fake all of these transactions.
No.
And so some weeks later, the investigators of Solarcom force SPI Inc. into involuntary bankruptcy. They stop paying the leases. The only other way out of it is to go bankrupt, and they bring in forensic accountants to keep tabs on Alan's spending. Have you ever worked with forensic accountants, Tom?
Yes, in some of the cases I've worked for at law firms, they've had to be brought in to reconstruct what exactly occurred after some lengthy history of questionable transactions, right? Because
yeah.
A lot of times, entities that are used for these nefarious purposes, there are so many things that are done to obfuscate what actually happened. You need somebody with a fraud or forensic specialization to figure out what actually happened.
Yeah, I've done some work like this myself as a CPA, and I have to say it's really interesting work. I love it because it's the epitome of the ultimate puzzle, because you're ticking and tying numbers and placing things in a fashion that you can see clearly what happened. But the sad part about that is then informing the business owner of what transpired. And I guess a big company like Maximus, you know, maybe there's not someone that's so personally tied to it, but especially when you're working with small business owners, it's devastating.
Yeah.
But despite all of these numerous investigations that were launched against Allen, he comes off as cool as a cucumber, all while continuing to commit fraud still, even while he's under investigation, which is crazy.
It's nuts. In 2005, the year after SPI Inc. goes into the involuntary bankruptcy, Allen takes loans out on behalf of CMAT and another CMAT offshoot that he formed the year prior. How is he able to secure these loans? Well, he fakes account receivables certificates, and the banks are none the wiser. He also claims in an IRS filing that CMAT has earned $5 million in revenue that year, but I highly doubt it.
Ugh. So he's masquerading because, meanwhile, his public persona is stronger than ever. He becomes a finance committee chairman for Michael S. Steele during his 2006 U.S. Senate campaign. I mean, what a better way to blow people off the scent.
Right.
Helps raise $8.4 million. Steele better count that money and see if all $8.4 million is there. He also volunteers to be a finance chair for Mitt Romney's presidential bid, and he even contributes $100,000 to one of President Bush's inaugural balls. And he and his wife, Jackie, got to attend. I kind of wonder, what is she thinking this whole time? She just thinks her husband is an incredible business person.
Also in July of 2007, he undertakes a luxurious family vacation to Egypt and Israel, but stiffs his concierge out of $100,000.
Ugh.
This might have been Allen's last hurrah because his empire of lies was beginning to crumble. Remember those loans he took out in 2005? No surprise, he can't pay them. The banks are practically breaking down his door demanding the $8 million he owes them, which he does not have. I don't think he'd have sold off his yacht and multiple homes, right? The jig is officially up. Justice is about to be served. On August 9th, 2007, just about a month after his family vacation in the Middle East, Allen gets hit with a 23-count criminal indictment. It alleges he defrauded his victims out of $32 million.
Oof.
It alleges he took the proceeds for personal use and even lied in bankruptcy court. A few days later, the U.S. District Court issues a protective order that prohibits Allen from, quote, transferring, encumbering, or otherwise disposing of property of the SBI estate.
That's a pretty short period of time, and that makes me wonder, where in the world did all of that money go?
Right.
$32 million. I mean, even if you are sipping champagne on a $100,000 yacht, you're talking about just a handful of years, right? It's like a 5 or 6 or maybe 7 year period of time when we look at the start of this story. And I just don't know, where does that much money go? I guess if you're flying private everywhere, that can add up pretty quick.
I could not imagine spending $32 million over 5 years. It just, to me, seems unbelievable. But I don't know.
And it's one of those cases where it's like, if only Allen would have put as much thought into a real legitimate business as he did into his crimes. Because you have to also remember, that's time consuming. Doing all these fake leases and coming up with fake accounts receivable, that's got to be a full-time job for him. So he's not even really working at this time. He's just working full-time at the con,
right,
I guess. And it's not very long before word gets around about his alleged criminal activity, and overnight, everybody in his orbit starts to react. And what do you think their reaction is? Republican politicians he's been closely associating with over those years, they return his personal donations, so everybody's cutting him off now and distancing themselves.
Right.
He gets asked to resign from the board of his kid's school. Everyone is shocked. How embarrassing for the kids. One of his former colleagues is quoted in the Baltimore Sun about the fraud, saying it completely boggles my mind.
Now, it's interesting, you know, everyone wanted to be in his orbit at one point, right? And yeah. Then it's like, as soon as it cracked, it's like, well, no, we never liked him. Well, no, we don't want his money. But his money was good when they thought it was legitimate, right?
Right. Well, did they think it was legitimate, though? Or as long as nobody questioned it, they just took it and happily spent it.
That's probably what happened. Well, in November, a superseding indictment is published, adding two counts of filing false income tax returns and one count of making a false statement to the IRS. Now, Dom, how do you think Allen pleads?
Well, if he were smart, he'd try to take a plea deal. But I assume that he pled not guilty.
Well, at first he pled not guilty. You got it right. But then in May of 2008, he eventually does enter a plea deal. He agrees to forfeit his properties, his cars, his yacht, and several companies. And he pled guilty to one count of mail fraud and one count of subscribing a false tax return. These crimes carry a maximum sentence of 33 years in club fed.
Well, even if it's club fed, he actually only gets 9 years. And he does have some other consequences. In 2008, of course, he filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy. He claimed about $4 million in assets while owing around $52 million. Why does he even have $4 million at this point?
That's a really good question.
But a judge grants an order of non-dischargeability, which means that Allen will have to pay back all his debts.
In the end, Allen only ends up serving 7.5 years in prison. It's unclear why, although he does seem to show remorse over his actions.
Uh-huh.
At his sentencing hearing years prior, he apologized to his victims and his family and admitted wrongdoing. And more recently, in 2021, Allen and his wife opened up about this rough period in their lives. Here's Allen speaking about it in a clip from the Grace Fellowship Church Facebook page.
Unfortunately, I made a series of really bad mistakes, and I was indicted in 2007, and I spent 7.5 years in federal prison. So that created a huge vacuum in our whole family and a lot of challenges. And as you measure stuff financially, basically we lost everything. Jackie struggled for all those years to make ends meet and just in so many different ways. Our whole family struggled because of my mistake.
Allen and Jackie claim that God has called on them to tithe a portion of their checks to the church. In return, they feel that God has provided for them.
Paycheck. Paychecks for fake loans?
Right. Who's hiring this felon, right?
I'm assuming he doesn't have a CPA license.
No.
Anymore. But hey, in addition to tithing, let's hope that Allen is reading his Bible and paying very close attention to the part where God says, thou shalt not steal.
Amen to that.
So, Tom, what is your take on this whole story?
It's about greed. I mean, it's simply greed. Allen was doing great. He had a successful business. He sold it, and it just wasn't enough. And he turned to crime to satiate this need for more material desires. And he didn't realize that there was no way this scheme was going to go on in perpetuity. It was destined that it was all going to come falling down. But again, that's okay. He got a couple years of private jets and a yacht. I hope it was worth the 8 years he spent in federal prison.
And it sounds like he's going to be making payments on that debt for a long, long time. You know, it's shocking to me when we do these cases about CPAs, because CPAs are known as being so frugal and penny pinching and driving the old beat up car and wearing well-worn shoes because we want to save a buck or two. And I wonder, when you say, Tom, he sells his company, I wonder if that is what started it. It was that taste of the good life. It was the taste of having financial freedom and having that big lump sum of cash that allowed him to give his family a better life, and he just couldn't stop.
Wait a minute, Dominique. Penny pinchers? You don't drive an old car or have bad shoes, from what I remember.
I do like a good pair of shoes.
Okay.
But it does dispel some of the stereotypes.
That too, yeah.
Yeah, it dispels a little bit of the stereotype of the very frugal and budget-conscious CPA. But hey, maybe he missed that class, or maybe he missed that training when he worked for Arthur Anderson.
Well, I think he missed the ethics sessions for sure.
You're right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. We're happy you've decided to join us. That's our episode for today, and we hope you consider subscribing to the show and even share it with some friends who could use a Tax Crime Junkie podcast in their life. Help us spread the word and come back for more.
We hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left open and close them for good. Until next time, remember that every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.